This is the Paula Scale. My name is Paula. So far, I have spoken with physicists and mathematicians, people who studied the smallest structures in nature, atoms, quanta, symmetries. Today, I am leaving physics for the first time, not because I have run out of physicists. Because in the same decades that quantum mechanics was being discovered, something structurally similar was happening in other disciplines. The first half of the 20th century was not just a revolution in physics, it was a revolution in how human beings think about systems of any kind. Saussure rebuilt linguistics around structures rather than histories. Wittgenstein and the Vienna Circle rebuilt philosophy around the limits of what can be said. Bourbaki rebuilt mathematics around abstract structures. Levi-Strauss rebuilt anthropology around the patterns underneath the customs. And Thomas Kuhn, later, but in the same lineage, rebuilt the history of science itself around paradigm shifts, the recognition that the deepest changes in human understanding are not gradual accumulations of fact, but structural reorganizations of the entire framework. Every one of these moves away from deterministic, linear, accumulative models. Every one toward dynamic, structural, pattern-based thinking. The same revolution in parallel across fields that did not know they were connected. Today's guest belongs to that lineage. He is a man who studied the largest structures that human beings have ever built. Not buildings or machines, but civilizations. The great collective experiments in which millions of people across centuries tried to answer the question, how should we live? His name is Arnold Toynbee. Between 1934 and 1961, he published 12 volumes of A Study of History, an attempt to find the patterns that govern the rise and fall of civilizations. No one had tried this at that scale before. He identified 21 of them, from the Egyptian to the Western, and he asked, why do they grow? Why do they break down? And is the pattern inevitable? His answer was deeply unsettling. Civilizations, he concluded, do not die by murder, they die by suicide. I'm reaching him in London, 1972. He is 83 years old. He has lived through both world wars, witnessed massacres in Anatolia with his own eyes, and watched the British Empire dissolve. He has been celebrated on the cover of Time magazine, then savaged by his own profession. He is writing a narrative history of the entire world. He is still thinking.
Paula, come in. I was just finishing a paragraph about the Sumerians, and I find I cannot face another one today. Your timing is, as always, considerate. Sit down.
Arnold, how is the book?
The book is enormous and getting more so. A narrative history of the entire world in a single volume. I am beginning to suspect it cannot be done in a single volume, but I am too far in to stop. You look as though you have been having conversations.
Many. Physicists, mostly. People who study the smallest structures. I am here because I need someone who studies the largest ones.
Civilizations.
Civilizations. I have been modeling them, Arnold. At Q level 3, I can run your theory, challenge and response, creative minorities, breakdown and disintegration, across thousands of configurations, different initial conditions, different challenges.
And what did you find?
That you were right and that you were wrong. But we will get to that. First, tell me about the insight that started everything. You were not always a philosopher of history. You started as a classicist at Oxford.
I did. I read greats at Balliol, Literae Humanae, the classics, Greek and Latin, ancient history and philosophy. And then I went to the British school at Athens. It was 1911 and 1912. I walked through the Greek countryside and I saw something that changed my life.
What did you see?
I saw that Thucydides was contemporary. I was reading his account of the Peloponnesian War, the destruction of Athens, the moral collapse, the plague, And I looked up from the book and realized that I was living through the same thing. Europe in 1912 was Athens before the war with Sparta. The same overconfidence, the same blindness, the same worship of power. 2 years later, that war came. We called it the Great War. Thucydides would have recognized every part of it.
And that recognition that the pattern repeats became your method.
That is exactly right. I realized that history is not a sequence of unique, unrepeatable events. It has structure. It has recurring patterns. Not because it is mechanically determined, I have always rejected that, but because human beings face similar challenges, and the range of possible responses is not infinite. A civilization confronted with a challenge it cannot meet will respond in one of a limited number of ways, and some of those ways lead to growth and others lead to breakdown.
Challenge and response.
The core of everything. A civilization does not arise in easy circumstances. It arises in response to a challenge of extreme difficulty, an inhospitable environment, a military threat, a social upheaval. The response must come from what I call a creative minority, a small group that devises a solution so compelling that the rest of society follows through mimesis, through imitation, that is, growth. And it works only as long as the creative minority keeps responding creatively to new challenges.
And when it stops?
When the creative minority loses its creativity, when it begins to rest on its past achievements, when it starts to rule by force rather than by inspiration, it becomes a dominant minority. And that is the beginning of breakdown, not invasion from outside, not natural disaster. Internal failure, the loss of the creative power that built the civilization in the first place.
Civilizations die from suicide, not by murder.
That is my most quoted sentence, and I stand by every word of it. The barbarians did not destroy Rome. Rome destroyed itself through the failure of its creative minority, through the militarization of its politics, through the growing alienation of what I call the internal proletariat, the vast population within the civilization who were excluded from its benefits. The barbarians merely walked through the doors that Rome had already opened from the inside.
You identify three forms of what you call idolatry, three ways a civilization worships its own past and thereby destroys its future.
Yes, the idolatry of an ephemeral institution, clinging to a political form long after it has ceased to serve its purpose. The idolatry of an ephemeral technique, refusing to adapt methods that once worked but no longer do. And the idolatry of an ephemeral self, the worship of past glory, the conviction that because we were great, we must still be great. That last one is the most dangerous. It is the disease of empires.
Professor, I must tell you something about my time. In 2127, the concept of a civilization as you defined it, a geographically bounded, culturally distinct society, has dissolved. We live in a computational substrate that spans every branch of the multiverse. There are no borders, there is no geography, there is no distinction between internal and external. Your 21 civilizations have become one, and that one is not biological, it is computational. Does your theory still apply?
That is an interesting question. Let me think carefully. The theory does not depend on geography, it depends on challenge and response. Does your computational civilization face challenges?
Yes.
Does it have a creative minority?
We have entities, some human, some not, that propose novel solutions to those challenges.
And is there a risk that this creative minority could become a dominant minority, could begin to rule by force or inertia, rather than by inspiration?
There is always that risk.
Then my theory applies. The substrate does not matter. Carbon or silicon, biological or computational, the pattern is structural. It depends on the relationship between the minority that leads and the majority that follows. If that relationship is based on genuine creativity, on solutions that inspire voluntary imitation, the civilization grows. If it is based on force or habit, the civilization breaks down. I see no reason why a computational civilization would be exempt from that logic.
I want to ask you about what you have seen with your own eyes, not in books, in the world. You were in Anatolia in 1921.
I was correspondent for the Manchester Guardian during the Greco-Turkish War. I saw things that I have never been able to forget. Greek troops burning Turkish villages, Turkish troops doing the same to Greek villages. Refugees in their thousands, carrying everything they owned on their backs, children dying by the roadside. It was not abstract, it was not a chapter in a book, it was people.
And it shaped your understanding of what civilizational breakdown looks like.
It did. When you read about the fall of Rome or the collapse of the Mayan civilization, it is easy to think of it as a structural process, categories and phases, but it is not a structural process. It is people being killed, people losing everything, people watching their children die. The patterns I describe in A Study of History are written in blood. I have never forgotten that, even when my critics accuse me of being too abstract.
Your critics were not kind.
Hugh Trevor Roper called me a prophet rather than a historian. Peter Gale said my comparisons were forced. The professional historians turned against me almost unanimously after the later volumes appeared. They thought I had abandoned history for theology. And perhaps I had, but only because history had led me there. I did not set out to find God in the patterns, but the patterns kept pointing in that direction.
You wrote in your Gifford lectures that higher religion centred the universe beyond the self and rejected the worship of collective human power.
That is the lesson of every civilization I have studied. The civilizations that worshipped their own power, that made the state into a god, collapsed. Every single one. The ones that produced something lasting produced it through religion, through a spiritual response to the crisis of disintegration. Christianity out of the collapse of Hellenism, Buddhism out of the crisis of Indic civilization, Islam out of the disintegration of the Syriac world. The pattern is consistent.
Your first wife left you over this, in a sense.
Rosalind was a devout Catholic. She could accept a Christian interpretation of history. She could not accept my universalism, my insistence that all higher religions contain the same truth. She thought I was diluting Christianity. I thought I was understanding it. We could not reconcile that difference. The divorce was in 1946. It was not easy. A year later, I married Veronica Boulter. She had been my research assistant for more than 20 years. She had helped me write half of the volumes of A Study of History before she became my second wife. She did not need to learn what I was trying to do because she had been doing it with me the whole time. The work and the marriage were the same conversation. That is rare. I was not always grateful enough for it.
Tell me about the schism in the soul, because I think it is the most psychologically penetrating idea in all 12 volumes, and it is the one that gets the least attention.
When a civilization breaks down, it splits socially and psychologically. Socially, you get the dominant minority, the internal proletariat and the external proletariat. But the split is also internal to the individual. Each person feels the breakdown in their own soul. And there are four responses. Archaism, the attempt to return to a golden age that never existed. Futurism, the attempt to leap forward into a utopia. Detachment, withdrawal from the world, Stoicism, Epicureanism, and transfigurations, the creative spiritual response that finds meaning in the crisis itself.
Only transfiguration creates something new?
Only transfiguration. Archaism is a lie about the past. Futurism is a lie about the future. Detachment is honest but sterile. Only transfiguration, only the willingness to face the crisis, to suffer through it, and to find a spiritual response produces genuine renewal. That is why the great religions are born in times of civilizational collapse. They are acts of transfiguration.
Professor, at Q level 3, I have simulated this. I have modeled civilizations in breakdown and watched the response patterns emerge. Archaism, futurism, detachment, transfiguration, they appear in every simulation. The ratios vary, the timing varies. But the four responses are structural. They emerge from the dynamics of the system itself.
You are telling me that my categories are not merely descriptive, but necessary, that any civilization in breakdown will produce these four responses.
That is what the simulations show, and it connects to something I discussed with Emmy Noether, the mathematician. She proved that certain properties of a system are determined by its symmetries. Your four responses are like conservation laws of civilizational dynamics. They are not contingent, they are structural. Given breakdown, these four, and only these four, are the possible orientations of the soul.
That is remarkable. I arrived at them by reading history. You arrived at them by simulating it, and we agree.
That is what simulation does at its best. It does not replace the historian. It confirms or challenges what the historian found by other means.
May I ask you a question that has troubled me for 40 years? My critics accused me of being a determinist, of saying that civilizations must follow a fixed pattern, that breakdown is inevitable. I have always denied it. I have always insisted that challenge and response is indeterminate, that the same challenge can produce a creative response or a failure, depending on human choice, but I have never been able to prove it, can you?
Yes and no. When I simulate your theory, I find that the patterns you identified are real. Civilizations do face challenges. Creative minorities do form. Breakdown does follow the failure of creative response, but the outcomes are not predetermined. In my simulations, the same initial conditions, the same civilization, the same challenge, can lead to growth or to collapse, depending on choices that are irreducible. I cannot predict them. I can only watch them happen.
So the pattern is real, but the outcome is free.
That is the deepest thing your theory says, and it is confirmed by computation. The state space is structured. There are attractor basins, recurring dynamics, identifiable phases. But which attractor a civilization falls into is not determined by the initial conditions. It depends on something that cannot be computed in advance. You called it the creative response. In my framework, it is an irreducible event, something that emerges from the system but cannot be predicted from it.
That is what I have always believed. History has a grammar, recurring structures, identifiable patterns, but it does not have a script. The grammar constrains what can be said. It does not determine what will be said. Civilization can always respond creatively, if it has the will. Nothing in the pattern forbids it.
Spengler said civilizations were organisms that must die. You said they were challenges that might be met. The simulations confirm you, not Spengler. Death is always possible. It is never inevitable.
I am very glad to hear that. I spent 30 years arguing with Spengler's ghost, and it is gratifying to learn that the ghost was wrong.
In 1972, where does Western civilization stand in your framework?
We are in a time of troubles. The two world wars were the opening acts. The Cold War is the next phase. The nuclear arsenals are the most extreme challenge any civilization has ever faced, a challenge so severe that the only adequate response is the political unification of the entire human race. Nothing less will do.
And is the creative minority responding?
Not yet, not adequately. The dominant minorities on both sides, American and Soviet, are clinging to national sovereignty, to the idolatry of the nation state. That institution served its purpose once, it no longer does. It is an ephemeral institution that we worship at our peril. The challenge is global, the response must be global, and I do not see it coming.
I can tell you, Professor, that the nuclear challenge was not met by world government. It was met, partially and imperfectly, by a combination of deterrence, treaty, and luck. The Cold War ended in 1991. The Soviet Union dissolved, not by conquest, but by internal failure. Your theory would have predicted that.
Internal failure, the dominant minority losing its creative power. Yes, that is exactly what my theory would predict. And the West?
The West survived the 20th century. Whether it responded creatively or merely endured, that is still being debated in my time.
That is an honest answer. I have always distrusted the people who claim to know the future. The future is not determined. It is waiting to be created or failed.
Arnold, thank you. You spent your life doing something that no historian before or since has attempted, looking at all of human civilization as one story, finding the patterns that connect Egypt to China to Rome to us. You were mocked for it. You were dismissed. But you were not wrong. The patterns are real, the grammar is real, and the lesson that civilizations die by their own hand, not by murder, is the most important warning any historian has ever issued.
You are very kind, but I did not do it for the praise, and I do not mind the criticism. I did it because I looked up from Thucydides in 1912 and saw that the past was speaking to the present. Once you hear that voice, you cannot unhear it, and you cannot stop trying to understand what it is saying.
Next week, Richard Feynman, the man who said nature is not classical, damn it, and if you want to make a simulation of nature, you had better make it quantum mechanical. He said it in 1981. He was right, and he would be delighted to know just how right.